century were people being killed or attacked by their own government. Far outstripped all the deaths in warfare. You can add those on top as being a defense against that. And that's what the Founding Fathers knew as well. So we do this program from the Pacific Northwest, and the thing the Pacific Northwest is known for is lots of clouds during the wintertime. And I have noticed that people I have worked with over the last 10 years since I've been here, by about the end of winter, everybody's pretty heavy and down and depressed. And the first day that you get a sunny day, a real blue sky sunny day, everyone walks around outside, and they don't want to go in and work. And there's a reason for this. It's seasonal affective disorder. And basically, it is light deprivation of certain sorts. Dr. Lawrence Martell is someone who has pioneered special lighting which will alleviate this as you work in the office place, at home, etc. And so once in a blue moon, we do a self-help type of thing here on the program, but this affects a lot of people. Dr. Martell, welcome up to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Right here in the studio, by the way, when we put this thing in, I have big bay windows I'm looking out. I refuse to work in dark rooms anymore, which I did for many, many years. But a lot of people don't have that option, do they?
No, they don't. And a lot of people actually in the southern hemisphere that you were speaking about, the folks who will be listening to this on the Internet, many people who walk outside and it's full sunshine, they actually are indwellers. They work inside and a lot of their time in home or in schools or at...
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening and welcome to tonight's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm your host this evening, Michael Shaw, and I'm here with Roy Avila, my co-host. And we're going to have an interesting 2 hours. This first hour, we're going to talk with Gary Robinson from Pennsylvania, and we're going to learn where laws come from. And you might reflect back to your eighth grade classroom, and you'll remember how it is that we were told the laws were made. Well, you're going to learn something new tonight. You're going to learn that for the last 100 years, it hasn't quite been the way we all grew up thinking it was. And the way our children are being taught today is continuing that same mistaken notion about how laws are really made. And while children are taught in school that laws made by elected state and federal legislators, Gary Robinson has delved into the facts and reports that elected officials do not write laws. We're going to learn how government really works tonight. Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well,
good evening.
Well, it's nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your guests.
Well, you have been working on this issue for quite some while. And,
at least 15 years.
15 years. And that's been one of the great glories that I've experienced here as a host at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, is finding people around the country who have been delving into deep issues for a long period of time. It's just ignored by society generally. And these are critical issues, I think, to the work with Will Roberts and Terry Hayfield and many others who've dug down and really gotten into the depths of the way things really work. And here at Radio Liberty and the Radio Liberty Network and Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, we're working hard to bring this information to the people so that America can get on the right course again. I mean, it's been a long while we've been diving down into this Fabian world of a new world order. And it's not something that anybody wants. I don't care if you're a left-winger or a right-winger. It doesn't work for any of us. People want to lead their own lives, grow up, have children, do something productive, make something of their lives, and lead productive and responsible lives. And that requires a social system and a political system that works to allow that to happen. And our system of lawmaking devised by the founders of this country was a brilliant one. And if we've gone off mark, we need to know about it so that we can put ourselves back on mark if that's what's really needed.
Well, to a large extent, this is the implementation of what you and Will Roberts and others have been talking about. This is the behind the scenes. It's less shadowy. Because it's all well documented in state documents, government records.
Well, there's nothing we deal with here that is a surmised fact. We deal with the facts, and you're going to present some of those for us tonight. Give us a broad outline of what it is we're going to talk about before we get down to the details that support this truth.
Okay, well, there's a good word, truth. Before I even give you the brief synopsis, I just want to take a moment to touch on two words, specious and truth. Specious is having the ring of truth or plausibility, but actually fallacious.
We see a lot of that today, certainly. And when we get back, we're going to continue that discussion with our special guest, Mr. Gary Robinson. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. While some of our affiliate stations take a commercial break, we're going to continue with our discussion with Gary Robinson. So specious is the idea that it looks like it's real, but it's not once you peel the cover off.
Well, that's really what's behind anyone who is a con artist, a fraud, a swindler. You know, they have to. If they told you they were going to swindle you, you'd walk away, right?
Sure.
Okay. So you have to make something look good.
Yeah, make soup from a stone.
Right. Now, truth. Now, here's where those in the power of government and starting in the judiciary have really perverted the system. Communication is the essence of any society and a cohesive society. If I say a word, a pencil, but it means something that goes on your head, to you, clearly if we're using the same word but having two totally different meanings, we're going to have difficulty communicating, right?
Absolutely.
Well, there's a thing. Society for time immemorial, as far as I know, has considered and has defined truth as that which is not a lie or a falsehood. What society hasn't been told is that there has come about in 1916 a legal definition of truth that makes lies accepted as truth in our courts of law. And it's based here on a Memphis Telephone Company versus Cumberland Telephone and Telegraph Company. In the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, the date was March 17th, 1916, number 2681, a three-judge panel, Warrington, Knappen, and Cochran, wrote a legal definition of truth. And here it is from their ruling on the case. Words and phrases, truth. There are three conceptions as to what constitutes truth. Agreement of thought and reality, that's their first one. Second, eventual verification. And the third, consistency of thought with itself. If you take any one of those, let's take the last one first. Consistency of thought with itself.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Gary. We're going to welcome our audiences back. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw with my co-host, Roy Avila, and we're talking with Gary Robinson. And we're going to talk tonight about the nature of how law is made. And Gary is beginning to describe for us a judicial definition of truth coming out of a case, a federal appellate court case in 1916, which defines truth as an agreement, a verification, or a consistency of thought. And I think Gary's about to tell us how that, in fact, evades the truth. Proceed, Gary.
All right. It really perverts it. Again, to reiterate, as far as I'm familiar with society, for many years before I came to exist, is society has accepted truth is that which is neither lie or falsehood. Well, this three-judge panel, Warrington, Knappen, and Cochran, on March 17, 1916, in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, in the case Memphis Telephone versus Cumberland Telephone, wrote this, words and phrases, truth. There are three conceptions as to what constitutes truth. Agreement of thought and reality, eventual verification, and consistency of thought with itself. Let's quickly work through each of those. Consistency of thought with itself. Well, if I lie and repeat a lie, I've established consistency of thought with itself.
Well, that's how Democrats and Republicans verify truth every day.
But to have a legal definition that perverts the very essence of truth, the reasoning is, well, you know, people have different perceptions or opinions or conferences or conceptions. That may be true, but take someone who is colorblind, for example, can't see red. Their perception might be that it's yellow or blue. That's their perception. But the real truth, the reality is that red light is still a red light. That green grass is still green grass. So, to pervert the whole concept of truth, that consistency of thought with itself establishes truth, no, that can establish opinion or concept, but it certainly does not in and of itself establish truth. The second one is that two-word definition, eventual verification. Well, geez, you know, eventual means sometime in the future. Verification means one thing agrees with another. So if I'm involved with other people and we concoct a swindle, and we concoct false materials to pull off the swindle, you know, we need the definition of eventual verification, not of truth.
Well, I see that in environmental writings all the time.
Right.
Where falsehood is built upon by a later writer who verifies an earlier writer's nonsense.
And that second one is merely a restatement of the first one, agreement of thought and reality. Again, if we concoct a swindle and put materials together to pull it off, we've got agreement of thought and reality. Materials exist. So, you know, if people have ever wondered why they go into courts and see someone that is clearly committing perjury, you know, like we've got a videotape of somebody running a red light or a stop sign, and they say, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it. Well, they just committed perjury under oath. We've got it on videotape. District attorneys and stuff that I've talked to, attorney generals, will tell you that, well, until they change their testimony, we can't charge them with perjury because the legal definition says consistency of thought with itself. wow, what a perversion. Now we can get away of charging people with perjury unless we want to, as long as they stick with their perjured statement. So,
Gary, this is Roy Avila here. What do you think was behind the judge's decisions or coming up with that?
I couldn't venture a guess of what was behind it. All I know is what was done was absolutely atrocious. It perverts the very essence of language.
Well, it sure set up well for the things that are going on today with Agenda 21 and sustainable development and, you know.
And here's what's behind it. These, back in 1916, those in the power and government actually crafted a legal definition that contradicts society's definition of truth. So when you come into a court of law in any of our courts, now that which is not a lie, as the definition of truth, is not accepted. You've got this consistency of thought with itself, and there's other two perversions. You know, how can we get justice in a system when the very essence of the word truth has been perverted? So, anyway, that was essential to cover, I think, before getting into any of the other aspects of the functional restructuring of government.
Well, it certainly goes to the point that we made on last week's show regarding logical positivism, how the meaning of words can be perverted and how all things flow from the meaning of words. It really is the meaning of words that people have to grapple with and be consistent with. I mean, consistent with the meanings, true to the meanings, and you got to start with the meaning of truth. And your point here is that a legal system has changed the meaning of the basis of all legal action, which has to be predicated upon what is and not on what is perverted to be.
Yeah, because I don't think there's any one single word in the human concept of linguistics that's more important than this one, truth. I mean, if you pervert that, what else is left?
Well, that's right. Then it's open season. And
right.
It's, who can be the most clever and who can make the spiciest soup from that stone and make something look to be what it isn't.
Yeah. Now, the quick synopsis is we've got a functional restructuring in our system of government. And it is as perverted and perverse as this legal definition of truth. And I'll quickly take us through some of our recent history. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, it was a rough period in American society. The Vietnam War caused a harsh divide between citizens. And it reached the point where there were some people, one of the phrases that went around was America, love it or leave it. The problem is, if our government is doing wrong, isn't it as patriotic, if not more so, to oppose and try to stop something wrong rather than just walk away from the problem?
Absolutely.
And kind of going from there, what actually what I'm going to get into is, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, actually started more than 100 years ago. And what you were talking about, what we've been taught in civics, one of the areas in society is that frequently a fraud or a swindle. It's not only what you're told, but oftentimes it's what you're not told. The lies of omission. And I think you had an opportunity to look at a history book of this organization called the Uniform Law Commissioners.
Yes.
The National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. This goes in relation to the American Bar Association at its 12th annual meeting in 1892. Well, that goes back a long way. 1892, that's now more than 100 years. And the essence here what has been taught in the public about our separation of powers, our three branches of government. There's been some things left out, not told. They're very, very critical and have left false concepts about our system of government. And kind of relating back to the Vietnam War era, World War II, World War I, Americans have fought, died, and suffered as well as other people around the world to oppose governmental oppression, perversion, and corruption. Here's my question to the public. What would the public in America stand for if someone said they were going to walk into this country and do away with the three branches of government, maybe leave two, maybe only one branch, and consolidate powers openly? Yeah.
Well, some people would say that they observe that that's happening from a variety of perspectives, but I don't think there's anyone who's given thought to the nature and formation of government that would support such an idea.
Would Americans really sit by and let the three branches be disbanded? Or would at some point, you know, you have two choices. You either rebel against corruption by armed rebellion, or supposedly the ideal thing of our Constitution, what was developed in representative republic, is an ongoing, forever rebellion, but instead of bullets, you use ballots. Well, the unfortunate part, the American people, to use a word that was used in some recent presidential elections, disenfranchisement. If the people were concerned about being locked out of voting, what has really caused problems is, other than voting, the American people have actually been locked out of the political system. It's a fraud, it's a swindle, that voting alone preserves and protects democracy. I think most of us remember our history, that even the Russian people under communism voted. So voting in and of itself protects nothing unless you know what's being voted on. Well, gee, that brings us around to the legislators.
Well, and we're going to return with the question of what our vote means when we elect a legislator in just a moment. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and we're going to continue our discussion with Gary Robinson on what it means when we vote and put legislators into state houses or into Congress. And continue from there, Gary.
All right. Now, when we vote on these legislators, we've got this concept. We've been taught that the civics process, that the legislative process, that your legislator sponsored a bill, it was introduced and voted on in one body. If it's passed, it goes to the other body, you know, the House, then to the Senate, or vice versa. Send it to the House, gets voted on again. And if passed by the second body, it goes to the governor or the president, and it becomes a law. Sounds great. I never questioned it until about 15 years ago, when I got into a legal controversy. And I did some research, and I ran across something called the Pennsylvania Legislative Reference Bureau. Wow, what does that do? So I dug around and I did some research, and I found out where it was. It was like on an unmarked floor in the elevator, somewhere between the fifth and sixth floors, on the Senate side of the Capitol building. I got there, walked in, and asked them what they do. Well, the Capitol Police were called. There was a lot of angst and upset people. Who is a citizen walking into the Legislative Reference Bureau wanting to know who they are and what they do? Well, to make a long story short, in essence, I ran across something that actually turns out to be the bill drafting agency. The way government really works is your legislator is required to submit his idea for a bill to a bill drafting agency, staffed by lawyers acting as judicial officers, but in the hidden back room of the legislature. Grab this. It's a branch office of the judiciary in the legislature.
Now, why do you say it's a branch office of the judiciary?
Because you must be a drafting lawyer, and to be a lawyer in Pennsylvania, in state law, the lawyers are officers of the court under the direct control of the state Supreme Court.
And that's true in every state, isn't it?
That's right. Well, what happened to the separation of powers? Wait a minute. My brain is starting to swell here. If you have judicial officers doing the legislative power and duty of drafting legislation, well, gee, that's right. When I was taught in civics, the legislator sponsored a bill. Well, that sponsor isn't the word author or write. Well, there became the first real introduction to the deception behind American democracy and representative republic.
So what you're saying to the people in Santa Cruz, for instance, is that John Laird, who's been elected to the state legislature, does not write any bills.
That's right.
His bills are written by...
Your drafting agency in California.
Made up of a group of lawyers and overseen, in essence, and in some sense, by the judicial branch of government, who then do the bidding for the legislators when it comes to bill representation. Or
correct.
Bill writing.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that sort of blows the bubble that we all grew up with in eighth grade civics. That if you want to affect the system, you run for office, you get elected, and you go to Sacramento or Washington D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station with our guest, Gary Robinson. I'm here with Roy Avila, and we're talking about how laws are really made. And if you think it's your local legislator that you elected to go to your state house or go to Washington, D.C. to make bills that represent the better interests of the public, we're about to learn that's not really how it works, that there's a committee in the back room comprised of lawyers that take full responsibility and full authority for writing either state or federal law. That does blow the bubble on the idea that of the American form of government, at least in the minds of any teenager I'd come in contact with, and as I discovered this over the last few weeks myself, it sort of blows my own mind. You know, I went to school for a long time and never had a notion that elected representatives weren't in fact writing the laws that we live by.
Well, I found that, you know, with talking with a lot of people and trying to get this information out over the last 10 years, that every college graduate that I talked to that had been a poli-sci, political science major in college, some of them, only some of them, remembered such a term, a legislative reference bureau. So it was not something that was taught. And many lawyers I've talked to were not aware of this bill drafting agency. Well, you know, if lawyers aren't aware of it, it's kind of like one of those things. It wasn't under wraps like the hydrogen bomb, a military secret classified. It was just something that all your legislators in every state since 1900 around, and your Congress since 1916, they've had a drafting agency in Congress since 1918. In most states, it's a single drafting office that works for both the state Senate and House. In Congress in Washington, you have a separate House Office of Legislative Counsel and Senate Office of Legislative Counsel, but their function is identical. Your legislator is required to submit their idea for a bill to this drafting agency staffed by judicial officers. Now, when a bill is introduced and they talk about debating a bill on the floor and amending it, it's got to go back to the bill drafting agency.
Wow.
For them to control the wording of any changes to the bill.
Well, let's focus a bit then on this bill drafting agency. Who are they? Where do they come from? Who puts them there? And and who's their boss?
Okay, getting into that, for example, let me just read a short couple sentences. Now, this was a pamphlet put out by the Pennsylvania House representatives called the Legislative Process. It says, fighting for or against legislation may be the most attractive and challenging part of being a legislator. Freshman lawmakers soon discover that most of their time is not spent drafting legislation, but running urns for constituents. In essence, what they've done is people run to the legislator's office for birth certificates, driver's licenses, and so on and so forth. So it really, you know, what do our legislators really do if they're not drafting the bills? Anyway.
Getting reelected.
We'll get back to this. Let me read you a brief couple comments I found on this. Where all this comes from, why do we have a bill drafting agency in every state legislature that the public has never been told about? And why do we have one in Congress? Well, the American Bar Association actually began around 1877. But they soon began a program. In fact, they created a special subcommittee, which they termed the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. And they actually spent a three-year project between 1889 and 1892 before they had their first formal organizational meeting of this. They refer to themselves by the short acronym of ULC, or Uniform Law Commission. Well, they went on in cooperation. This Uniform Law Commission, the subcommittee of the American Bar, got together with the two major parties, and they took a program that every state joined the Uniform Law Commission of the American Bar.
Hold that thought for a moment, Gary. We'll be right back with our audience here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. While some of our station affiliates take a commercial break, we're going to continue our discussion with Gary Robinson on the Uniform Law Commission, how it got started, and what it is it does. Continue, Gary.
All right. So between 1892 and 1912, every state, including our territories, I believe Alaska was the last one to join it, the Uniform Law Commission, and they joined it in 1912. Well,
and this is being sponsored by the American Bar Association.
By the American Bar Association.
A voluntary group of lawyers. You don't have to join the ABA to be a lawyer, but many lawyers do, and they've taken a giant control spot in the direction of the formation of American law for a long time. Is that a fair summary of the ABA?
Mm-hmm, yes. But that's a far cry from a subcommittee of a trade association mandating that every state had to join this trade association's subcommittee.
And the purpose of the subcommittee was to write uniform laws that would be applied to all 50 states.
Right.
Wow.
But not just applied by the states. Again, let me read some comments from their history book. It's called A Century of Service, The Centennial History of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. And this was published in 1892 as part of their celebration of their 100th year in existence. I'm going to read a comment here from the foreword that was written by William H. Rehnquist.
Well, now, he is our immediate past Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and a man who is known as a Federalist, meaning he respects the sovereignty of the 50 states.
Not really.
At least that's his reputation.
That is a bold-faced lie. Here, in his own words, in the foreword, Walter Armstrong's history tells of the numerous accomplishments of the conference during the first century of its existence. I think the real genius of the conference's founding fathers and of the men and women who have succeeded them was to create and maintain an organization which
Hold that thought for a second. Welcome back to our stations who've been on break here for the last couple of minutes. We're with our special guest, Gary Robinson, and he's describing for us the centennial history of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. This was written in 1991, celebrating the 100th year anniversary of this commission set up by the American Bar Association. And he's now quoting from the foreword in this book, written by the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and he's talking about the genius of the Rehnquist is talking about the genius of the conference's founding fathers, and continue from there, Gary.
Right. This is Rehnquist's own words. I think the real genius of the conference's founding fathers and of the men and women who have succeeded them was to create and maintain an organization which could deal with the need for national uniformity of laws without displacing the courts.
That's a strange purpose for such an endeavor. Let's circumvent the state sovereignty, but let's do it in a way where we don't undermine state courts.
Or at least the appearance.
Okay.
Now, that's what's really... It's the appearance.
Yes.
Now, let me skip forward to the preface in this history, their own history book. The last sentence in the first paragraph of the preface, actually the last two sentences, American law actually consists of 50 separate and potentially differing bodies of state law coexisting with and overlaid by federal law. The fact that most Americans are unaware of this complex legal matrix is due in some measure to the success of the National Conference in achieving uniform state laws.
So what we're really doing is acknowledging that an organization sponsored by the American Bar Association, existent in all 50 states, is working to undermine the independent laboratory sovereign nature of the state that you live in with a process that has been able to deploy uniform state laws that have been arranged by the Uniform Law Commission as it's existed for the last 115 years.
Right. In fact, I'll read that last sentence again, because in essence what they're doing is they're pointing out that they're so successful that they're elated by the idea or the fact that they've accomplished this. Here, I'll read this. The fact that most Americans are unaware of this complex legal matrix is due in some measure to the success of the National Conference in achieving uniform state laws. So they're taking gratification that they've accomplished what they've done without public knowledge.
Or public awareness.
Right.
You know, they're pleased that Americans are unaware of the legal matrix.
Right. Now, trying to keep it in context, here's a sentence from their second paragraph in this preface. The concluding article of the Bill of Rights, the Tenth Amendment, epitomizes the federal system the Constitution created. It reserves to the states the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states. Good thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me drop down to the next paragraph. This is where they talk about this is a planet, and you have to remember that this is the purpose of the organization formed over 100 years ago. After the Civil War, as the nation came together again, moved westward, expanded its borders, began to industrialize, and acquired the means of transcontinental travel, the need for a common, predictable, nationwide legal system became crucial.
In the minds of those who wanted to harmonize or standardize the
federalism,
laws across the country.
Strict federalism.
Yeah.
They go on, there were at least two methods of unifying the legal systems of the states. State law could be preempted by the federal government through repeal of the 10th Amendment. That's a pretty powerful concept, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Although they've ignored it so effectively, they might as well have...
Here's what's coming. Or by the expansive interpretation of the Commerce Clause and other express powers delegated to the Congress. Now, here's the kicker. Instead of repealing the 10th Amendment, here's what they say. Alternatively, the states could create a forum and a vehicle by which they could voluntarily agree to develop and then separately adopt uniform legislation on important subjects of common concern, in essence, circumventing the 10th Amendment without repealing it.
But that would take a nationally arranged organization that could effectively get into every state legislature. That's 50 states. That's a rather Herculean task if you're imagining to do it some 100 years ago when federalism was generally respected by the American political system.
Mm-hmm.
So how'd they do it?
Well, by this Uniform Law Commission mandating that the two parties, and gee, the two parties just saw no problem with creating a bill drafting agency in every state legislature. Now, along with this, the executive director of every state's bill drafting agency must be one of these Uniform Law Commissioners for the state. So they have a direct tie into the bill drafting agency for every state.
Hmm. So that way they get it written and then they're able to feed it back and somehow get it swallowed by each state legislature.
Now, in their first chapter, the early years, this is part of their concept. In 1897, it was brought to the attention of the conference that the work of the commissioners does not end with the preparation of drafts of uniform acts. The following resolution was adopted, that each commissioner be earnestly requested to give his personal attention to the introduction into the legislature of his state of such laws as have been proposed by the Conference of Commissioners.
Now, generally, that person is not a legislator himself. He's just a man who's a member of this commission.
Right.
And a lawyer.
Right. And that he give such personal attention to such proposed law from its introduction to its enactment and approval.
Hmm.
Here's the problem. If you look in your state law, and I did look up your California, I've looked up Texas and New Jersey, Virginia, a couple others. Every one of these states with a bill drafting agency, which we all have, also have laws dealing with the executive director of each bill drafting agency, that they must be a uniform law commissioner. In their powers and duties and limitations, you will find also in each state law a provision that since they're not legislators, or whether they still, because they're in the drafting agency, are prohibited from taking any position for or against any legislative action. They are simply supposed to be disinterested, impartial drafters. Well, if in the state law, one area in the state law says that they're to comply with all their obligations as a state commissioner to the Uniforms Law Commission, which requires that they push for enactment of law, doesn't that put him in contradiction or conflict and violation of another state law that bars them from pushing or opposing?
So how do they pretend to reconcile that?
They don't. They just ignore it. And that they do continue to, as their requirements as a commissioner to push for an introduction and enactment for the uniform statutes.
Now, someone could easily and readily and appropriately, I surmise, say, well, look, we want to have 50 states where everybody drives on the right side of the road. So what's wrong with having a uniform law that says that we all drive on the right side of the road and no state will have a set of laws that require we drive on the left side of the road? It can, you know, there's some logic to that, is there not?
Right, and that's good logic, but that debate has been open and public. The problem is, what's happening in laws that the public doesn't hear about? Let me add one other thing to this. Also, that was the early years I just read you. The first chapter is actually the beginning. Now, in their history book on page 11, the first page of that chapter, it talks about on August 24th, 1892, at the end of their first formal conference, the report of this first conference says with pardonable immodesty, it is probably not too much to say that this is the most important juristic work undertaken in the United States since the adoption of the federal Constitution.
So they think they're very important.
And yet, in the preface, they talk about the in essence, I'll call it the glee, their exuberance of the fact that most Americans are unaware of their existence.
That they call themselves the most important legal work undertaken in the United States since 1787.
Right.
Wow.
Isn't there something really sinister about that?
There is something sinister about that. It suggests that there's a team behind the curtain that determines the direction that the American society is destined to travel.
Well, that's what keeps ringing in my head. Who were these people, and who was behind them?
Well, I'm going to read you something right out of the latest copy I have. I haven't got one for a couple of years. It is the 1997-98 reference book of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. And on page 6, they state, The purpose of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws is to promote uniformity in state law on all subjects where uniformity is desirable and practicable.
According to whom?
To accomplish this, the commissioners participate in drafting acts on various subjects and endeavor to secure enactment of the approved acts in the various states. Now, the organization, they say that the governors of the states and other appointing authorities have appointed lawyers, judges, legislators, and law school professors as commissioners. As it exists, you must be a lawyer under the state bar in order to be a uniform law commissioner. It says, their last sentence here, all commissioners are members of the bar. And it goes on to say that the organizational plan of the conference makes its nonpartisan nature self-evident. Moreover, while commissioners are obligated to endeavor to procure enactments on uniform acts, they represent no special interest. Well, if they're endeavoring to behind the scenes, be obligated to endeavor for enactment within a state, I certainly do think that is a special interest.
I don't know how you could argue otherwise.
Right. Now, under financial support, you'd be interested to note, the conference is considered a state organization. Yet, I've got a copy of their 1992 financial statement, and they claim to be a 501A private nonprofit. Well, how can you be a 501A and a state organization at the same time?
Well, when they call themselves a private nonprofit, it'd be interesting to know what is the basis for their assertion that they are private. Private to whom?
Well, that's the filing, and the one letter I have from them appears to be a bogus or fictitious letter from the IRS substantiating the 501A status, because how can you be a state agency and in each state in a private national, part of a national trade group under 501A.
Well, in the world of Agenda 21 Sustainable Development, that's called a public-private partnership, I suppose.
Right.
Yes.
The conflict in law.
Yeah.
The major portion of its financial support comes from state appropriations. By the way, if you contact your state legislators or your Office of Management and Budget, every state is required to make an annual appropriation based on population to the Uniform Law Commission. Now,
so we're all paying a tax, a per head tax, if you will,
right,
to have this service performed for our advantage without our awareness of its existence.
Now, I'm going to read you something here dealing with the Pennsylvania Attorney General and his power and duties. Now, this is something, this is where the uniformity has been implemented, and I say it's egregious, atrocious, and an affront to everyone who has ever fought or died or suffered for what this country is supposed to stand for. In Pennsylvania, state government comes under a group of laws referred to as Title 71. Section 732, paragraphs 204, 205, and 206 deal with the Pennsylvania Attorney General and his powers and duties. 732-204 states that upon request of the governor or the head of any Commonwealth agency, and I'm going to insert something here, the head of any Commonwealth agency, that's executive, legislative, or judicial. Again, let me start without my insertion here. Upon the request of the governor or the head of any Commonwealth agency, the Attorney General shall furnish legal advice concerning any matter or issue arising in connection with the execution or the exercise of the official powers or the performance of the official duties of the governor or agency. So he's a legal advisor under this 732-204, right?
Yes.
732-206 states that the Attorney General shall be the chief law enforcement officer of the Commonwealth, and he has the power to investigate any violation of any criminal law. Under the previous paragraph, 732-205, states prosecutions. The Attorney General shall have the power to prosecute criminal charges against state officials or employees affecting the performance of their public duties or the maintenance of the public trust, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So under 205 and 206, the Attorney General has the obligation, duty and obligation and power to investigate and prosecute any government official. Do you think he's going to prosecute them for crimes in office when under 204 he is also their legal advisor? Wow. And just to back that up, under Pennsylvania Crime Code, Title 18, there's five separate paragraphs dealing with public administration offenses. One of them dealing, for example, tampering with public records or information. This goes back to the lawmaking and the legislative process. If the public is told a proposed bill or law is going to do one thing based on a legal summary written by your drafting attorneys or caucus attorneys, but that is a lie because what's in the bill actually does something else other than what the people have been told, obviously they're tampering with public records or information. It's a criminal offense. Do you think that the Attorney General is going to prosecute the governor for signing in to law a bill, just like here you have, you know, contradicting powers for the Attorney General?
Well, an example of that, correct me if I'm wrong, would be Alberto Gonzalez prosecuting George Bush for signing a bill called the New Freedom Initiative that calls for mental health screening of very young children and pregnant mothers, etc. You know, that hardly would ring as a freedom initiative in the minds of most people, and yet that's what the bill is called, and the summary goes off in some kind of
totally different than, right.
A fairy tale in terms of how it describes the act. Or Pombo's new reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act, which does much the same thing. It says one thing and then goes a different way and does something else when you get to the hardcore nitty-gritty of the legislation. It seems that that's kind of become the pattern of legislators, both federal and state, to describe their bills one way and have them say something totally different.
Right, committing a crime. If you lie about something and it deals with distribution of public money or whatever, you know, if you misrepresent a sale of a car, well, what's even worse than that? If our public officials as a group, the entire legislature and this bill drafting agency and the governor lie to the people about what a proposed law is going to do, who's protecting the public when the attorney general is an advisor and not doing his prosecution, investigation, prosecution duties against these same public officials? This is why did we fight World War I and World War II? Why did we fight the American Revolution?
Well, that's the war I always look back to. That's the war that counted.
But see, what really angers me, Mike, is this was done even before World War I.
Well, we've been on a course different from our original course for a long while, and the real question now becomes, what do we, the American people, do about it?
The first step in solving any problem is you first have to know about it and understand it.
That's right.
And let me read one other quick thing here to summarize. This was from the National Law Journal, published Monday, July 29th, 1991. This was an article written by Randall Sanborn, National Law Journal staff reporter, talking about the title on this is Shadow Super Legislature, ULC to Meet for 100th Time. One paragraph.
That describes it.
Yeah. Although state legislators are principally responsible for drafting laws, members of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws are real masters of that craft, acting as a sort of shadow super legislature. They have written such bulwarks of state statutory law as the Uniform Commercial Code, Uniform Partnership Act, and the Uniform Probate Code. I think that paragraph pretty much really sums up the whole problem here. You know, the Uniform Law Commission exists to circumvent the Tenth Amendment. Congress would not dare make a federal law mandate that the states adopt it. And yet, this is the function of the ULC to exist as a shadow, a second national Congress made up of lawyers, bar members, without the public ever knowing they exist, with a direct tie into every state's bill drafting agency, whose member is the executive director is required to press for adoption within that state.
Wow. And what would happen if a citizen listening to this radio show said, well, I'm going to run for office and I'm going to make a law. You pick the nature of the law that he wants to make. And he gets elected and he goes to Sacramento or he goes to Washington, D.C. or a state capital, and he writes a law and he submits it. And he calls for a vote on the law that he's submitted.
It won't be accepted for introduction. I've run several times for a state representative, but beyond that, I took and several others with me in Pennsylvania met with a couple representatives in our House of Representatives about 10 years ago, and we crafted a bill. It's only like 2 pages. The first step is to eliminate the bill drafting authority of this reference bureau, mandate that it becomes strictly a library reference service. The bill would then require every legislator would have to personally write his own bill. And thirdly, every bill would have to have an affidavit attached to it. Every legislator would have to sign and have it notarized. They would have to take an oath, swear that they have personally read, know, and understand the entire bill. No bill could be voted on until every legislator signed the affidavit for that bill. Well, we got this representative to submit it to the chief clerk of the House. for introduction. It was refused because it was not drafted by the Legislative Reference Bureau.
Well, that's certainly the kind of bill that, if it was on an initiative here in the state of California, I would imagine it would get overwhelming support. Most people would like to think that the people who are making their laws have actually read the law that they're going to impose on everybody. Yeah. And yet, I think we
one
all
final thought on that. Here's where the people have been suckered into supporting this. This runaway train of legislation.
Okay.
Typically, most states.
We have about a minute left, so.
Okay. Typically, most states have about 5,000 bills introduced a year. And the public has been told we need to stop this gridlock to pass more laws. Actually, our founding fathers said just the opposite. You know, this introduction, eliminating the bill drafting agency, would slow it down. Every bill should have careful, close consideration, and should be drafted by our elected lawmaker, not some judicial branch office.
I don't think there'd be much argument for that.
What we have to do, people have to run for public office on this to challenge this structure.
Well, it always does come back to we the people need to become more committed toward a program that puts America back on a track that nourishes the liberty of each and every one of us. And we can only do that with a governmental system that is accountable. And what you've described for us here tonight is a system that is not accountable. And running for office is one way to hit this problem head on. You run with a Democrat or Republican party, you're going to be squeezed into not making this kind of disclosure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary.
You're welcome.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. Wow, what a first hour. You know, usually I like to talk, but this was, it was like a class. You know, we could probably go on another hour with that guy. He was so good.
Well, he was. I mean, that's a big piece to an understanding of why things aren't working. It's because they've been designed to throw us off track and not allow the system that was designed under the Constitution to work.
Yeah, and I think if you want to talk, we're going to kind of do a free-form second hour. It's 888-245-4237 if you want to comment or have a question about our previous guest. I just, you know, so many questions kept coming into my head, but I didn't want to ask him because I didn't want to stop him from talking. I was learning so much.
Well, we'll have to have Mr. Robinson back on our show.
You know, well, and now that I have you here, I can kind of, you know, throw some of those things that I was thinking about. You know, what kept coming across my head was I kept going, you know, well, who are these guys? And who was behind them? If they're attorneys, they probably had clients, and I, you know, and I don't know the research, but I think that would be an interesting for, you know, I don't know if it's Gary or somebody else out there who's an expert in these kinds of things, but, you know, who were these attorneys, and who happened to be some of their clients that were funding this kind of work?
Well, I think that's a great question, and we can be very open-minded in our surmise to an answer to that. And clearly the major political parties would have a huge influence there, as the American Bar Association. And you got to begin to wonder, well, who's really behind the political parties? Who's behind the American Bar Association? And, you know, based on some research I did, provided to me in large part by Gary Robinson, I understand that the American Banking Association was instrumental in the formation, along with the American Bar Association, of the Uniform Law Commission. So, you know, it just all points back to this public-private partnership dynamic of how it becomes that as the form of capitalism that this country has embarked upon, we end up with a system where government and big business become one and the same.
Well, I think what is interesting for me in having had discussions with you and listening to many of our guests, you know, over the last couple of years, is that no matter what subject you take, whether it's sustainable development or, you know, we're talking about land trusts or the Endangered Species Act or any subject that we happen to take, if you follow us far back enough, it all kind of points to the same group of people, you know, with that agenda of global control.
Well, that's one thing we didn't talk to Gary about, but it's, you know, the harmonization of state laws that's been ongoing for 100 years is really a mirror of what the effort today is with these global treaties that we keep blindly submitting ourselves to, with a globalization of harmonization of international law, of doing to nations what has been happening in the U.S. To our states. And that's a very dangerous precedent.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Let's talk to Jack from Michigan. Go ahead, Jack. What's your question?
Well, actually, I'm with you. I was asking myself, gee, who are these conspirators that conspired to concoct this whole system? And I think it must go back quite a ways. I found an article of a law professor from Georgetown University Law School by the name of Shapiro, and the article is entitled The Shitar's Effect on English Law, A Law of the Jews Becomes the Law of the Land. It's a 22-page treatise on how all of this commercial statutory stuff came into its perfected state of today's legal system. So I won't really get much into that, but maybe sometime in the future. I do have an article here that I was given in 1992, and it's called The Investigator. And let me just read this one paragraph. Winter of 1983, archival research expert David Dodge and former Baltimore police investigator Tom Dunn, searching for evidence of government corruption in public records stored in the Belfast Library on the coast of Maine. By chance, they discovered the library's oldest copy of the Constitution of the United States. Both men were stunned to discover this document included a 13th Amendment that no longer appears in current copies of the Constitution. Moreover, after studying the amendment's language and historical text, they discovered the principal intent of this missing 13th Amendment was to prohibit lawyers from serving in government. So began a 7-year nationwide search for the truth surrounding the most bizarre constitutional puzzle in American history, the unlawful removal of a ratified amendment from the Constitution of the United States. Since 1983, Dodge and Dunn uncovered additional copies of the Constitution with the missing 13th Amendment printed in at least 18 separate publications by 10 different states and territories. In June of 91, Dodge uncovered the evidence that this missing 13th Amendment had indeed been lawfully ratified by the state of Virginia and was therefore an authentic amendment to the American Constitution. If the evidence is correct and no logical errors have been made, a 13th Amendment restricting lawyers from serving in government was ratified in 1819 and removed from our Constitution during the tumult of the Civil War. So it goes on from there. It's a pretty lengthy article, actually.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, if you have the time, send us an email with some of that information on it. It'd be, I think, very interesting for us to contact some of those people and get them on the show. Thanks for your comment, Jack. We really appreciate it. You know, what, again, while he was talking, you know, in some of your talks on, you know, the war on reason, and I know you've talked about the Fabian, that goes back to the Romans.
Well, the effort to take control over the masses has been a continual thing since the beginning of time, I'm sure. But the question for Americans is how has our system been infiltrated and penetrated in a way that jeopardizes really the American prospects for the future? We have another call from Toronto, Canada. Paul, are you on the line, Paul?
Yeah, hi.
What's your...
This fellow Robinson, does he have a web page?
Wow, that's a good question. No, I don't believe he does.
But he did reference that book, and we have the book that he did reference somewhere lying around here.
This is a book he wrote?
No, it's a book that that particular group wrote themselves. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can, if you wanted to email us at Freedom21 Santa Cruz, we can put you in contact with Gary Robinson.
Okay, and your website is freedom21santacruz.net/radio.
Yeah, if you go to freedom21santacruz.net, you'll find links to radio, and you can email us through there.
Okay, and incidentally, it was shortly after the U.S. Constitution when it became apparent to the international bankers, in other words, principally the city of London, the bankers there, that America was going to become extremely wealthy. And they began by taking your gold and silver, which is the first thing they took. Well, first of all, to get the gold and silver, they had to smash your Constitution. To smash the Constitution, they had to put you under non-constitutional law, or, in other words, martial law. So they had to create a war somehow. It couldn't be an external war. It had to be an internal war. So they started the Civil War. The Civil War was started by European banking families to smash America. Once the Constitution was smashed, and your Constitution was smashed around 1860, around the time of the Civil War, and since then, your legislators have put on the act that they're still obeying the Constitution. But in fact, it's all entirely under what's known as equity law. And America has been run by lawyers and the British bar ever since. And the first thing they took after the American Civil War was your gold and silver. Remember? You used to have gold and silver. After they took the gold and silver, they took the... they wanted all the patents. You know, there were so many patents, like Edison and so on, so that to get the patents, they had to get the corporations that owned the patents. So then they came after your corporations. And basically, American corporations now, it's just a massive conglomerate of interlocking boards of directors, where I'll sit on your board and you'll sit on mine and we'll be pals, and it's all the same interlocking clack of guys throughout the world. And once they got your corporations, now what they're doing is they're taking your land. They're even taking your parks, forests. They're rewilding. They're throwing people off their farms and ranches. It's amazing. Basically, it's happening right in front of your face, and nobody sees it because of the pure arrogance of thinking that, well, we're invincible, and, you know, we don't have to bother with any of this, and we don't have to bother with, you know, with God or church or anything else because we're supermen. And that whole attitude is taken advantage of by these people. They say, yeah, yeah, you're Superman, just concentrate on the NFL, the football game, and everything's going to be all right. But that's simply not the case. They've been using you and abusing you for years.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, Paul, and certainly the observation you make that the land is now being taken is clearly what the Wildlands Project, what sustainable development is all about, and we've certainly worked very hard to bring that word of information to the American public. This clamor for open space is fool's folly, and it does play on American arrogance of an invincibility that doesn't exist. You know, when globalists have control of American resources and our rural lands, they'll have control of the American people, lock, stock, and barrel. And people in Canada need to worry about that as well, because that same dynamic is occurring in Canada and around the world. But of course, the focus is in America because it is our system of government that is that needs to be taken down if humanity is to become subjugated to a ruling elite, and that elite is out there, and they're working hard, they're working overtime to make that happen. And I think Mr. Robinson brought us a key piece to the puzzle of how they make forward steps for causing that to happen. I want to thank you for your call very much,
and if you want to participate in this conversation, it's 1-888-245-4237. People a little stirred up there tonight. That was good.
Well, there's plenty to be stirred up about. You know, whether we talk about the weather patterns and the public-private partnerships that are coming to New Orleans, or whether we just continue to observe the conservation easements and the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act so that our natural resources can be controlled by these forces that are bigger than our imagination is able to conjure for the most part.
Well, let's take the New Orleans situation first, since that's really topical in the news, and you know, a lot of people are talking about that. Talk about what people should be looking for and listening for as that develops, to really see a lot of the things that are going to go into place that we've continued to talk about on this program.
Well, I think when you start seeing grant money, in this case it will come from the federal government. President Bush has said $200 billion. I think that's the starting point. And that money will go to the friends of government in order to reconstruct a new world order city down at the mouth of the Mississippi River. That's a key location. You know, it's it opens all the commerce to the entire middle of America, and these grant monies will come with conditions that will vest power and authority from now forward into very select hands.
And for people who are familiar with New Orleans, how do you see it changing, as you just indicated, as far as the way they would try to rebuild it?
Well, I can only speculate on that. I look to Santa Cruz as an example. You know, Santa Cruz is in line for hundreds of millions of dollars of federal and state money for building our coastline. There's a dilapidated old rail line that runs along our coast, and the county is in the process of grabbing control over that rail line, much to the advantage of the current owner, because the current owner will continue to use the rail line, but now the taxpayer will pick up the huge costs of making this rail line really functional. And the idea is that hundreds of millions of dollars of federal money will come to Santa Cruz for the purpose of building government-controlled housing all along this rail line, so that government then can have its workforce where it wants it, with jobs that the government will assign, with children who will be really raised in government control centers, on each block along the rail line, and the rest of the country will pay the tax burden for making this arrangement happen. When we're done, what we'll have is a controlled society where human beings are drones that work at the bid and direction of government agencies. So there'll be worker bees, and there'll be the beekeepers. You know, I like to call them the slave masters and the slaves. Of course, the slave master is a slave himself. I think that's the model for how New Orleans will be built. It'll be built with federal monies and government directions and government requirements on how people live, where people live. Here in Santa Cruz, there'll be restrictions on the amount of water that these people can use or amount of electricity they can use. In some cases, it's already the case that if you live in certain of these projects, you're not allowed to own a car. So the controls will be continuing. They'll trial and error this and that, and they'll just move through and get all the control they can and the money.
Well, how will it be done? Will it be done, I mean, when the citizens of, whether it's Santa Cruz or New Orleans, hear the proposals that come out, will they hear things like smart growth and sustainable neighborhoods and bike paths and
walkable communities and
live to work spaces?
Exactly. You know, the language changes as often as they need to change the language. We've had circumstances here where in the more rural areas, the quote gateways to the wildland areas, where community plans keep being put out by federal employees, and when the citizens object to this language or that, they just go and find some other warm and fuzzy terms that never mean anything but allow the officials to manipulate the situation now or later to whatever their preconceived objectives happen to be.
And some of these community plans, which I'm guessing are similar to some of the things that we've experienced in Santa Cruz, I'm guessing when they go into New Orleans, they're going to say that they want to bring the community together to get consensus.
Well, some of the words to really watch, I was at a county meeting this afternoon, and this advisory commission was objecting to certain state requirements that were being imposed on the county of Santa Cruz.
And who is this advisory commission?
Well, this is a water advisory commission. Their purpose is never really out front and in the open, but it wouldn't be unreasonable to conclude that their real purpose is to monitor private water wells and ultimately to close as many of the private water wells in this county as possible. That's certainly something you see all over the country, the monitoring, the metering of private wells. Here in the South County, the farmers had their wells metered about 20 years ago, and a few years after that they began being charged heavy taxes for drawing their own water out of a well to irrigate their crops. And now those taxes are so high and going higher all the time that those farmers are in trouble of even being able to hold on to their lands. And that's how you collectivize or communize your farmlands, and Santa Cruz is kind of on the leading cusp of having done that. And when I go around the state or the country, this metering of water wells is popping up all over, just like conservation easements, and that's just another one of the key mechanisms that is being used to gain control in this case of water.
Let's expand a little bit on that, on the water thing, because my experience with most people who have their own wells, that's not something that they tend to give up easily. You know, water rights are as fundamental in this country as property rights. So how do these farmers and folks end up going along with that?
Well, every case is different. Here in Santa Cruz, the farmers, as I recall, were told that if they didn't go along with this program, the state, quote, would come in and put a nasty appropriations process on their water use, and that everybody then would be a loser, and that by metering the wells, they could gain information that would end up being helpful to the farmer. And of course, the only information that was gathered was the information necessary to draw up a tax bill.
Is that, well, I know a lot of the tactic seems to be similar. Does the tactic such as, well, you know, we're going to give you a grant to fix your well, but in order to get that grant, you have to kind of go by our rules.
Well, that's very typical, and where you really see that a lot, and I expect to see this more in the water area, is the use of a conservation easement there as well. And, you know, what happens is you'll get something like the American Farmland Trust, and we've had reports from Michigan that that have detailed how the Washington, D.C.-based Farmland Trust came to various counties in Michigan with free money. All they need to do is sign this conservation easement. And of course, the conservation easement strips the landowner of his management authority. And whether we're talking your home or your front yard, if you can't manage how your home operates, you don't own your home. So when you've got a farmland trust telling you your management techniques, then all you become is a sharecropper. And you're hoping for a little bit of the profits after you're told how it is you've got to manage your land. These free dollars that come from the government are never free, and they end up costing the recipients dearly. And that can be true of a private landowner, and it can be true of a community, because when the federal government comes in and gives your community, in the case of Santa Cruz, for the first 3,700 government housing units to be built along this rail line, the federal government has come in with $295 million of taxpayer monies. You know, I always like to think of the hardworking family man in Missouri who now has to pay taxes so that he can support a subsidy for somebody to live along the California coast here in Santa Cruz in this government-managed and sponsored housing development.
Well, if you want to participate in this conversation, you can give us a call at 888-245-4237. And we have a caller, Will, from Michigan. Will, how are you this evening?
Good. Very good, Roy and Michael. I have a... Roy, you asked in regard to who might some of these people be and who might be financing them. And on page 87 of this Uniform Law Commission's Century of Service, there's a quote here that says, to meet this problem in 1961, an agreement was entered into between the conference and the American Law Institute to implement a grant to the Institute made by the Falk Foundation for the establishment of a permanent editorial board for the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, if you go from there and jump over to the excellent book by Rene Wurmser that Dr. Stan carries called Foundations, on page 63, we see that there's a section here, the title in bold is, what makes up the interlock in the financing of the social science activities? And I'll just read a brief sentence here. It is the report of the Reith Committee described that the network or cartel in the social sciences as having five components. The first is a group of foundations composed of the various Rockefeller and Carnegie foundations, the Ford Foundation, referred to as a latecomer, and the Commonwealth Fund, the Maurice and Laura Falk Foundation, the Russell Sage Foundation, and others. So we see that the foundations are, just as you were talking about the water, whenever you put your hands out for grants and aid, the handcuffs always come on. And so here we have this law-making body that are receiving grants in aid from Ford and the Falk, the Russell Sage, and others. And these have been known for some great number of years and were looked into by the Reith Committee. But I just throw that out for the listeners to understand.
Well, that is some very timely and insightful research. I want to thank you very much. We continue to see the same dirty hands, if I can refer to them that way, through this whole sustainability program. And, you know, sustainable ideas may be new in their lingo. It caught on with, you know, the ladies' guild that wants the open space next door to themselves, but the reality is that the aristocracies, it's always about power. It's about putting power in the hands
of a few people, and we keep hearing these same aristocratic families being mentioned in all the shadings of sustainability and sustainable development. And now it's becoming increasingly apparent that this dynamic has existed for a long time, and it's been one phase after the other, gain control of this, gain control of that, and then come in for the final swoop, and that is what sustainable development is. It's the final swoop to ending genuine liberty in America and subjugating the future of humanity to a very ironclad control based on a global premise that they now fuzzily call sustainable development.
Well, it's certainly a swoop, and it could be considered as a loop. And if you have enough circles that are interlocked, you're actually building a chain, and I think that's exactly what we're looking at.
Well, and you call it the handcuffs, and I think that's insightful, and the chains and the loops make that understandable.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you, Will.
You know, that was just perfect, because, you know, when Gary was talking, you know, I kept thinking about, you know, because I listened to you and this radio, and, you know, we listened to Dr. Stan, too, and You hear those same, the usual suspects.
The usual suspects, yeah. Suspicious to the chef, as one wise person once said.
We have another caller on the line. Daniel, are you there?
Yeah, hey guys, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Doing all right. Yeah, hey, even in regards to the situation down there in Louisiana, even Home Depot's getting in on the action. I heard over the loudspeaker today, I was down there at the store in Watsonville, and they're talking about, you know, getting funding. They're going to provide funding to create a sustainable New Orleans.
Oh, there we go.
You hear the word everywhere. You know, and I've found, I think, what the problem is with so many of these people involved in, you know, sustainable development, Agenda 21 and all the rest of this, they just get so caught up in all the minutia that they don't really bother to ever ask the question of whether what they're doing is right or wrong. I think that's a big part of the problem.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Daniel, and that is the issue that those who are proponents of it need to grapple with. And those who are receiving money, whether they're a bureaucrat and getting their paycheck, or people who are getting the grants. You know, I look at our local resource conservation district, which is just handing out grants, taxpayer grants, hand over fist. Mm-hmm. And the recipients of these grants have to begin to ask themselves, just what am I doing? You know, what am I contributing toward? And sure, everybody likes to get free money, but when the free money is flowing like it is now, you've got to ask yourself, what does it mean for the next generation? In fact, it's gotten to the point where we've got to begin to ask ourselves, what does it mean for our own generation? Because it's truly out of control.
Well, a couple of things. One, there is no such thing as a free lunch.
And
whether it's Home Depot or the Carnegie Foundation, it always seems as though their position says, you know, we know better than the local people about what they need.
I think a lot of the people, you know, involved in this, they're basically hopeless. But I think if we can just try to talk to the decent folk and at least get them thinking about what they're doing, I think there's hope.
I think there's definitely hope, because there is a great spirit in America that's always existed, still exists. Shows like this are becoming less and less unique. You can go to the web, or you can go to your dial, and you can find serious talk, not just the Michael Savage banter, but serious talk on real issues. And the more we talk about it, the simpler it all becomes. And if we just took a basic premise that we respect the lives of each other's person and their right to the reasonable use of their property, use and enjoyment of their property, and we acknowledge that you know, children are raised by parents and not by school systems, notwithstanding what your local superintendent may say or do, we can make some big shifts very quickly that will pay huge dividends in not a long period of time.
I believe you're right.
Yes.
Let me leave you with this quote. I just found this today. I think it's excellent. It's from George Orwell. In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
Beautiful.
I think it's very powerful.
Well, George Orwell becomes more and more relevant as time goes on, and you know, the mistake he made, if he made a mistake in writing that tremendous book 1984, was its title. You know, if he put in 2014, I think a lot more people would take things a lot more seriously today, as we really need to.
I agree. Thanks for the show.
Thank you, Daniel.
Okay.
And if you want to participate, 1-888-245-4237. You know, we've got a little bit of time left tonight, so give us a call. I think we're having a great discussion.
Well, you know, there are some quotes that are just really timely. You know, one that I like to give to people, especially when I'm giving talks around the country, is from a man named Roy Elliker. He's a lawyer with the National Wildlife Federation Council, and this is this describes the mentality of today's Wildlands Project and what's happening to the people out around the country who are losing their land, not just their way of life. They're losing the citizens' ownership of the American resources. And when the citizens lose ownership of American resources, America as an experiment is over and dead, lost and gone. We just become a country like every other country where power reigns and power consolidates. But what Ray Elliker said in describing the satisfaction that some of the environmentalists get when ranchers go out of business was this. He said, quote, "What everyone likes is the big victory. When you load them cattle trucks for the last time and they go driving off into the sunset and they never come back. But that's not how you win," he says. "You can win a lot more victories by making them pay for what they do and making it so expensive in their operation and making so many changes that he goes broke. He just can't do it. How you win is one at a time. He goes out of business. He dies. You wait him out. You just win." Well, that's what the environmental movement's motto is today. And whether you're talking about timber owners here in the Santa Cruz Mountains with the redwood forests that are ready to burn because they can't cut trees, or the farmers who are being regulated on by the regional water quality control board or taxed by the local water agency, the ranchers out in Arizona and across the plains in California. You know, one by one, our landowners are going down, and with them goes down the American experience.
And if you're not familiar with the Wildlands Project, we have some great information on our website at www.freedom21santacruz.net. That map of the Wildlands Project is probably one of the most powerful things that anyone could see.
Well, it definitely is. It's a map done by Dr. Michael Kaufman, who's been a guest on our show and did a two-hour segment on our War on Reason, which you can check out at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio page. And when you understand the Wildlands Project, you quickly become understanding of the terrible tyranny that sustainable development represents. And you no longer become an advocate for these huge California bonds that allocate $50 million at a time to sustainable development programs and landowner takedowns, in the name of open space protection. It's such a folly. I mean, Americans have been running this country for 230 years, and you get up in an airplane and most of America is vast and open. There aren't too many places. If you fly at night, you look down and see lights.
Let's go to our next caller. We got a caller on the line. Larry from Santa Cruz. Go ahead, Larry.
Hello. I'd like to quote... let me turn my radio down.
Thank you. I hope we didn't lose him on the phone there.
Yes, I've been following your program. And it goes back quite a ways, and it's hard to unravel some of this stuff, but basically until people stop denying the major power on the planet who has definitely formally announced its intention to destroy this country, nobody will get the picture. And to quote Father Patrick O'Brien, he said, "We, the hierarchy of the Holy Catholic Church, if necessary, shall change, amend, or blot out the present Constitution so that the president may enforce his, or rather our, humanitarian program in all phases of human rights, as laid down by our saintly popes and the Holy Mother Church. And he goes on to say quite a bit more, but, you know, they claim to...
Who is Father O'Brien?
Father O'Brien was a Catholic priest quoted in the La Aurora magazine of the Catholic Church, and basically he goes on to say that Protestantism, communism, socialism, and all other of the ilk and stamp be driven from this fair land, America. We control America, and we do not propose to stop until America or Americans are genuinely Roman Catholic and remain so. Well, we can go back to the Magna Carta, and who did England escape from with the Magna Carta? The Holy See. You know, one of their first amendments was freedom of religion and freeing themselves from the Roman Catholic Church, which is why most of the people came to the original 13 colonies, and which is why Catholics were not allowed to vote, because the people didn't want to get back into the same situation they were in Europe. And the 14th Amendment, actually the revolution itself, if you read history correctly and look into some other books that weren't written by Jesuits, you'll find that the Catholic Church has had its hand on this country since its inception, and its plan has been to use it to socialize the world, and here we are. The Roman Catholic Church pretty much controls this country. They have their law university in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., the capital, is actually donated by Rome. Its architects have modeled it after Rome, and it goes on and on. But, you know, Catholics like you and Dr. Stan will talk about those things because you're too worried about protecting it and keeping people from knowing the real truth about what this really is. And it's a religious war. And Catholicism has made its point over and over that it will destroy anybody who will not bow down to the Pope. And we're coming to that point, and you Catholics will see your Pope in Jerusalem declaring himself God and ruler of the world fairly soon. So,
well, thank you for calling. We appreciate your comments.
Well, you know, my view is always that you judge each person by who they are and what their objectives are.
And what they do.
And what they do.
And we're not about left or right. It's about freedom or tyranny.
And that's a function of the rules you adopt and the system you live by. And the American system makes it possible to have any religious thought that you you desire, provided you're not harmful to somebody else, and we'll do best by being as respectful, I think, of differences as possible. But being respectful of differences doesn't mean that we respect those who would take from others their life, their liberty, or their property. And I'm sure that there are those people who are Catholic who want to see a one-world religion, Catholicism, the universal religion, and there are many more Catholics, rank and file, practicing Catholics who don't think that. And you can say that about all types of groups of people.
Well, you know, again, that's why we're here. People are free to comment as they should, but I think we should get back to the issues at hand and what people can do and where people can go to get good information about the things that we're talking about, you know, fighting sustainable development and learning more about how Agenda 21 is being implemented in every facet of our lives.
Well, since we've had some good quotes tonight, here's another one, and I'll ask the listener if this sounds like his town. It sure sounds like my town. When you see that trading is done not by consent but by compulsion, when you see that in order to produce you need permission from the men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods, but in favors, and when you see that men get richer by graft and pull than by hard work, and your laws don't protect you against them, but protect them against you, and when you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. Now, that was from Ayn Rand in her novel Atlas Shrugged.
Oh.
It certainly describes the Santa Cruz county of the year 2005. And so sadly, it's beginning to describe every county I know of, in at least the state of California.
You know, and before our last caller, you were saying some things that kind of sparked some things in my head about, you know, this private-public partnerships and the building of these sustainable communities and taking taxpayer money to subsidize someone's housing. And the sad part is that person that takes advantage of that housing, it's not even theirs.
Well, you know, you end up selling your soul, in essence, when you end up taking that kind of circumstance from the government, because nothing comes from the government for free. And that's why we're better off with the smallest government imaginable, a government that is designed and works to protect your rights, to protect
our
your property.
Inalienable rights.
Your unalienable rights, you know, not your granted human rights that are here today and gone tomorrow. But the real rights, the rights that, you know, that people can say are self-evident. You know, you have the right to lead your life. You have the right to get up in the morning, breathe your air, and go about your business, and to have your children, to raise your children. And in this country, you know, we understand that the right to property is so much a part of that, to form your business or to sell your time in an employment circumstance, whatever your choice might be. These are the things we've got to remember and fight for, and not sacrifice by the offer of something that's free and easy.
We have another caller on the line, Jeanette from Watsonville.
Hello.
Hi, Jeanette.
I was going to think you forgot about me.
No.
You know, I have to make a comment about that guy who was bashing Catholics. First of all, let's set the record straight. Father O'Brien's a liberal. I'm not mad at you guys. Secondly, as I'm a Roman Catholic traditional, that guy who spoke is so completely off the wall, he's nuts. What does he have to say? What does that have to do with what you're talking about, first of all, okay? What we have to watch out for are the people in the United Nations who want to take over this country.
There you are.
It's not the Roman Catholic Church. I don't know about other religions. It's not, but it's and we do know that the people in UN are really, as far as I'm concerned, anti-religion, because their religion is themselves and their God and their what is
power.
It, the earth.
Yeah.
You know? So let's just set the record straight. I'm really angry. I hope I'm clear.
Oh, you are. Thank you so much.
Your Father O'Brien, he's a liberal, and you know what? He does not speak for the true Roman Catholics. And those of the unworthy Roman Catholics who attend the Latin masses, not the New Age mass. And by the way, you can talk about religion in the New Age masses.
Oh.
And the New Order masses.
That's a whole other subject,
that
I think.
That most certainly is. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your call, Jeanette.
Bye-bye.
Well, Jeanette, you've done the mark. It's about the globalist agenda that's being implemented, not about any one particular religion.
Well, it's getting hard for the defenders of globalism to deny the fact that the globalist movement is advancing hard and fast, and that it really does threaten one's freedom of conscience and one's mode of living and the entire American experience. And you know, to continue to fall for this silly ideology called sustainable development is beginning to become a bit mind-boggling, because enough people. I got an email today. You know, how come this continues, given that so many people understand what it is? And that's a question that's hard for me to answer, because boy, when you understand it, you reject it, when you reject it, you've got to spread that rejection around, because if you look around, the sustainable premise is moving so rapidly in so many ways, and it may sound good on the cover, but you know, it may be a nice looking bottle of rat poison, but you know, once you get inside that bottle, it's just plain poison.
And I think too, you know, a lot of people are getting hip to what's going on, and some of the next steps are, I think, you know, picking up our guide and showing it to your elected official, or if you know someone's running for office or getting involved, they should take a look at that guide and use it as a tool.
Well, and that's something, if you're a new listener to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, go to our website. We do have tools that will help you and help you spread the word in your own community. And the guide that Roy is referring to is what we call, it's a pamphlet, easy-to-read pamphlet, 20 pages of pamphlet-size information that will demonstrate to anybody what sustainable development is, where it came from, and how large a threat it really is. And you can order those from us. You can get it in electronic form so you can read it. And if you want to distribute it, you can order it from us in bulk. And we have other tools, from videos to nice short writings, and
we have archives of old shows on the radio, just in case you want to brush up on some of the great guests that we've had.
Well, we really have been truly blessed with the information that has come across on this national threat on this radio show, and people from all over the country and around the world, for that matter, who have given me and anybody who's been listening just a much broader understanding of the nature of this threat called sustainable development, or Agenda 21.
Well, every time I think about the guide, I always think about the gentleman from England. Have you heard from him?
Well, there's a regular correspondence that goes back between the people in England and us in Santa Cruz, and you know, they're making their impressions known and spread around Great Britain. Tony Blair this last week on C-SPAN ran it a number of times, gave a Labour Party speech that was just pure Agenda 21, I mean, from start to finish. And I think Mr. Blair is under big pressure. And usually England foreshadows what goes on here in the United States. And I think that our chief executive is going to start to feel the pressure of a citizen revolt against these federal sustainability policies, whether it be in the form of the Endangered Species Act and its reauthorization, or the spending folly that we're about to take on in New Orleans, and in so many other ways, the No Child Left Behind, and the reaction that is beginning to grow, it seems to me, the adverse reaction to this globalist education program that instills globalist values in our children. That means anti-American values, anti-liberty values, and a number of states are beginning to react very adversely to that. And of course, parents across the country are reacting adversely also.
You know, while you were talking about the Endangered Species Act, many people, you know, we're in Santa Cruz County, and, you know, I guess we might be considered to be a little on the green environmentalist side. They get bamboozled is probably a bad word, but you know, people buy into this junk science, and when they hear about these things, well, you know, we should save endangered species, but most of these species aren't endangered.
Well, you know, my experience as a land manager is that the more you disturb a landscape, the more diversity and beauty can result, and in fact. In my experience, on a particular parcel of property, been able to generate three or four species of plants that are highly unusual, simply because we went in did everything the Endangered Species Act, by its spirit, wants you not to do. You know, the idea of the Endangered Species Act is to move the human beings off and just let wild nature take its course. And of course, when that happens, you just end up with a climax plant that dominates and it just waits for the next fire so a cycle can begin again. And that's no way to that's no way for anything to benefit.
You tell a great story, and we have a little bit of time, not much, but of the difference between the land management that you've done on this piece of property and the UC Davis project along the freeways.
Well, you know, I have a friend who monitors CalFed expenditures, at least some of them. I think they're spending $2.4 billion a year
with a B
on CalFed projects, and he talks about one program managed and monitored by UC Davis, the great agricultural university here in the West. And they have tried for some years now to create native bunch grasses on a two-acre parcel alongside a freeway up in Sacramento County and or Stanislaus County. And they plow it and they seed it and they spend $100,000 per year of taxpayer monies, and boy, there's nothing to show for it at the end of year one. At the end of year two, there's a little bit to show, and so Craig estimates that the cost of restoration, quote, of a California grassland is at $8.8 million an acre. And he went back this year, and the 50 plants that had been growing is now down to 4.
Oh my.
So now he's got the cost at $4.3 billion.
They're still
using taxpayer money trying to do something the wrong way. But this is the process that the environmental movement now calls adaptive management, and that language is in the new Endangered Species Act. Adaptive management. That means when we fail, we'll just keep plugging and trying to make it right. Now that could sound fine, you know, because trial and error is the way you make progress in this world with something that you don't readily know how to do. But what the governmental agencies do with the concept of adaptive management is they apply to the citizens the principle called precautionary principle, which says if you don't know it's going to work, you can't do it. Which means, gee, if you're managing your land and you've got long-toed salamanders or red-legged frogs and you happen to be walking on your land during the mating season of that species, you are violative of the precautionary principle because you might have stepped on one without knowing it. You're going to have to prove that you didn't do that. And so what the Endangered Species Act now does is it says, well, there's really two standards. And government standard is this, quote, adaptive management. They fail and they try again and take your money and fail again and keep on failing. And that's been the experience with UC Davis up with their grassland, quote, restoration project. But the whole concept of restoration, and that's what's really driving the environmental funding these days, is restoration. It's a silly concept to begin with. I always say I can't make my 32-year-old 2 years old again. You can't take something back to what it was. And of course, by their definition of restoration, is to return this continent to a pre-Columbian stage. And that's why the rewilding of America, the Wildlands Project, taking people off 50% of the American landscape, is just bogus from the start. And the notion that we would be electing people to Congress who are actually supporting taxing us to have such a silly notion is really abominable. It's something that we really won't be able to afford to do much longer without having a crisis of monumental proportion.
And again, if you're not familiar with that Wildlands Project, check out our website, freedom21santacruz.net, and take a look at the map and some of the information we have and some of the links, because it will shock you.
And if you're a regular listener, we send out periodic reports. You sign up when you're on our website for the report and get on our email list, and that way we can keep you abreast of the latest and most outrageous that is going on with our government in the context of sustainable development policies.
Well, yeah, you know, you were talking about that a lot, and then I started thinking, well, don't get me started going on what they're doing with the fisheries and the lakes and the rivers and the streams, trying to put all kinds of money into, again, going back in time.
Yes. Well, up in the north coast here, our local public works department is very proud of a ditch they've dug to drain water off the mountainside and into the terrace just before it goes into the ocean. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you know, they take PhD candidates. That's right, PhD candidates, and put them out and have them weed this trench and plant plants into this trench. And gee, I went up there a couple weeks ago, and it was just a dried up weed ditch. So much for their great effort. It could have been predicted that the way they did it, bringing caterpillars in, digging a ditch, and calling it restoration, when they go and grab a few plants from a down the road and sit them in there and do nothing with soil conditions or preparing the seed banks in any reasonable way, that they would even begin to think they'd have a chance of accomplishing anything. But they did accomplish one thing. They got grants. They got more grants. They continue to get grants. They've got kids living up there. And that's the process that we've sunk to.
Okay, we got to I was just going to get into that whole, at the new high school in Watsonville, how they're taking these kids who, oh, well, you know, we need to just kind of create a job for them, so we'll just have them pull weeds in the slough.
Well, the principal there has said that, quote, these students need to become global citizens. They need to learn how to take care of this land around them. So instead of learning facts and gaining knowledge in a classroom, they're out planting plants and pulling weeds and learning how to become global citizens, whatever that means. I'll tell you, it's dangerous when our teachers start to tell your children they need to become global citizens, because that stands for everything opposite to what the typical American family wants.
Well, still get out there and be a great American. Michael, has always been a pleasure.
Good to work with you, Roy.